having me. I apologize for not being able to see that person, but there are reasons beyond my control that I just wasn't able to. But I really appreciate the opportunity to give you a call for me by me. So I'm talking about some work that I've done over the last year or so with several people. Some of the work includes Philip Natalia at Perimeter and some other, and also I'll be talking about some other work that includes some people here, some astrophysicists of miners here, staff at Stanford. So the topic is search for new GPL forces, and let me begin with sort of a broad introduction. So as a particle physicist, you know, our quest is to try and understand the fundamental of matter and its action. So there's been an effort over the years to, you know, go from to find out what the fundamental building blocks are, to find out what's in an atom, what's inside the nucleus that's inside an atom, what's inside the proton that's inside the nucleus, and so on. So going to shorter and shorter distances to find out what the fundamental constituents are and what their interactions are. And we have built up a very successful standard model of particle physics. And there are, of course, six forces that are part of the standard model. That sounds strange, chart, bottom, and top. There are six leptons, three charged leptons, and three neutrinos. And there are three forces, the strong and electromagnetic force, which are mediated by the gluon, W boson, and the proton. And together with gravity, those make up the four forces that we know about. So this model is extremely successful. It's a well-defined theory standard model. We know what we can sort of add to it, and it's so successful, but it is incomplete. And the reason it's incomplete is that we have, over the years, measured the energy density of the universe, and we know that the standard model only describes about 4%. So this little, the pie chart here, this little thing at the bottom. And 22% of the energy density of the universe is dark matter. We know dark matter exists. We don't know what it is made up of. We don't know the particle. We don't know how this particle interacts with us, or rather, we don't know if it interacts with us. We only know matter just through gravity or that other interactions with us. And then, of course, there's 74% dark energy, by which the standard model is not set. So there are other parts of the standard model. There are massive W and B bosons, electrically broken. There's more matter than antimatter. There's the baryon asymmetry. And there, of course, the fundamental particles are massive, and all these questions are not addressed as such standard model. So many outstanding questions suggest this new physics. And in biophysics, we hope that we'll find the answers to these questions. And there are basically three frontiers in particle physics which are trying to find these answers. So there's the energy frontier, at which we're trying to go to higher and higher energy. There's the cosmic frontier, where we're trying to find out what is the identity of the dark matter particle, and does it have interactions with ordinary matter that is not just gravity. And then there's the intensity frontier, where we are using low or medium energy experiments to collide a large number of particles to look for tiny deviations from the standard model. So the one frontier that most people are already familiar with, and the one that has got a lot of attention, of course, right now, is the energy frontier. And the idea here is that we go to larger and larger energies to find, you know, heavier particles, more massive particles. And over the years, we found, you know, of course, electron muon, the proton around the GeV scale here, and heavier leptons and quarks, and the gauge bosons, the heavy gauge bosons in the standard model and particles. And the exciting thing is that the energy error is here, so we're trying to find out what other particles are sitting here at the weak scale, what other symmetries are there, maybe there's a Higgs boson, maybe there's a symmetry, maybe there are copies of the Z boson, such as the Z prime, and other things. But besides this, there is actually an orthogonal axis to this energy front, to this energy or mass axis. And this is that this axis is described by particles. How strong the coupling is of particle to standard model to ordinary matter. So in particular, what I'll be talking about in this talk is the idea that there are very light particles that are mediating a new force, but they have a very weak coupling to ordinary matter. And in particular, I imagine these particles are between the MAB and the GeV scale. So it's an energy scale that we've probed already a long time ago, but we haven't probed it with the accuracy or the precision that would rule out the existence of new particles here that have very weak coupling to ordinary matter. So this is basically the thing that I want to focus focus on this idea that there's a new force that's mediated by a low mass particle with a mass in the energy to TV range that has very nothing to ordinary matter. And the primary way that I'll talk about to probe for the force carrier is at the intensity frontier. One way to look at this, to probe this, is at long energy E plus minus colliders. So these are E plus minus colliders with an energy between around 10 GeV or so, 1 GeV. The Babar collider here at SLAC is an example. There's also the Bell collider. That's another very good example. And what I'm showing here is a plot of luminosity on the vertical axis and energy on the horizontal axis. And there are experiments, for example, in the 1970s were done. So here's between 1 and 10 GeV. These are E plus and minus colliders. And in the 1970s, you know, we reached a luminosity of 10 to the 29 particles per centimeter squared per second. And over the years, over the last three, 4 decades, we pushed that up now to 10 to the 34 per centimeter squared per second with the Babar collider at TET2 and also Bell at TET B. And in future, of course, there's SuperB, which has just been funded now in Italy, which might run, you know, sometime later this decade. And you see that over the last 30, 40 years, we've pushed up the luminosity of these colliders by 5, 6, 7 orders of magnitude. And this really gives us a new tool to study for very weak interacting particles. The other experimental facility that I'll be talking about is using an electron beam on a fixed target. So instead of colliding electrons and positrons, you just take an electron beam and shoot on the fixed target. A prime example is the electron beam facility at Jefferson Lab. Jefferson Lab is one of the national labs in the United States. They have a 1 to 6 GeV electron beam at their latest there. They're located about 3 hours southeast of Washington, D.C. And they're very high intensity electron beams, and with that you can also look for new particles. So I'll be telling you about a new experimental research program that's underway. And the idea of this experimental research program is to undertake a systematic exploration for new GeV scale forces, so for new particles with a mass between energy and GeV range. So just going back to this plot, so the reason this has gotten a lot of attention recently is mainly because there are hints from various experiments that are looking for dark matter, and that might be seeing dark matter, and they suggest that dark matter has new interactions with the force carrier in the MV-GV range. I'll review those in a few minutes. So this, of course, has exciting implications for the cosmic frontier to look for these, allow you to look for these particles. One thing I want to briefly mention is something that I will not discuss due to time constraints today, but there are also dramatic signals that are possible at the energy frontier, where you might be producing supersymmetric particles that then interact also with this force carrier, and you might get some very interesting signals at the NHC, for example, or at the Tavatron. But I won't discuss that today. So instead, here's the outline for the rest of the talk. I'll first describe in more detail what I mean with a new force. I'll discuss what the hints are for such a force. Then I'll discuss two different probes of this. One is at the cosmic frontier, and I'll tell you how dark matter annihilation and force galaxy can constrain indirectly the force carrier. And then I'll discuss the intensity frontier, so E plus and minus colliders, as I mentioned, and then also fixed target experiments, and tell you how one can look for this new force. So let me tell you about the idea now. So we have this dynamo of particle physics sitting on one side here. There's quarks and leptons part of it, and there's a free force carrier, the gluon, the WT boson, photon. And they, together, of course, are described by a gauge theory. And the idea will be that we add a hit detector, which consists of particles that do not couple to any of the known forces. So there's an hidden vector of particles. None of these particles in this hidden vector will couple directly to any of the known forces. We will consider that dark matter is part of this hidden vector. That is, as what I mentioned, has driven a lot of the excitement of the last 2-3 years, why is such private money? Why is such reports like this? And we will introduce the sending sector, we will introduce a new force into the sending sector. This fiber I'm going to call the A prime. It is described by a U1 sort of median force, so basically a copy of hypercharge, but it's a different U1 symmetry. And I'm going to imagine that this U1 is broken, so that this A prime is massive. So unlike the photon, this A prime is a massive particle. And so, but I should say, the name A prime, many people use different things. For example, like to use a different symbol for A prime for this new particle. There are many other people that use different symbols, but I'm going to call this new force carrier A prime. So if this is all that exists, this would not be very interesting. Of course, the way to find such an insect is that it somehow needs to couple to the standard model particles. And the question is, how can you couple the insect to standard model matter? And there are many ways, there are a few ways of doing this, not that many, but there are a few ways of doing this. And the one I want to focus on is the idea by Bob Holden at Toronto, who said that the photon in the standard model can mix with this new force carrier, this A prime. So both of these are U1s. Photons are described by U1 electromagnetism, and this A prime is described by U1 symmetry. And it turns out that you can then mix these two sexes through mixing with the photon and the A prime. So how can this mixing come about? So this is the diagram we want to try and generate from some new physics, some high scale physics. There's a photon on one side, there's the heavy photon, you can think of this as a copy of the photon, just heavy as it. And there's a big thing parameter, which I'm going to call epsilon, that tells you how strongly these two sectors are going to be coupled. And one way to generate this is to imagine that there are some heavy particles, which I'm going to call X here, that are interacting with both the photon and the A prime. And that allows you then to generate this mixing between the photon and the A prime, if these particles come to both the photon and the A prime. And at the Lagrangian level, what you're generating is basically this term is operated here, so mixing between the photon kinetic term and the A prime kinetic term. And the reason, so you call this usually kinetic mixing, because you're mixing the gauge kinetic terms of these two forces, these two fields. And there's a parameter here, epsilon, that sits in front of this. So in principle, epsilon could be order 1. There's nothing that forbids it to be large, at least theoretically. Of course, there are strength constraints on this parameter, which I'll discuss in a while. But epsilon could even be order 1, and you can easily build models where epsilon is like 10 minus 3 or so. But the thing to notice about this operator is that it's not suppressed by any mass scale. There's no explicit mass suppression that comes in. So it can be very large. So what is the effect of this mixing? It is basically to generate a coupling between the A prime and the quark, to the quarks and the charged leptons in the standard model. So the A prime couples to ordinary matter, and the way it does that is because the photon couples to electrically charged matter, the quarks and charged leptons in the standard model. It couples with a string that is denoted here by E, that should be electric charge. And then the photon mixes with the A prime string epsilon. So effectively, the A prime couples to electrically charged matter with a string that's epsilon suppressed compared to the photon coupling. So there's some massive particle between the MeV and GeV range that couples to quarks and charged leptons. So the mass of the A prime, in principle, could be anything. It turns out that you can build models, which I don't want to describe in detail, but you can build models to the model supersymmetry, which naturally generate an A prime mass between MeV and GeV. But this mass range that I want to consider between MeV and GeV is also motivated from data, as I will describe based now. So let me tell you about the hints for the A prime. And we've seen, well, I've tried to argue at least, that theoretically it's sort of very natural. All you need is a U1 and some hint sector, and the A prime is the force carrier of that. And then it's very easy to generate this kinetic mixing piece here, and then allows in this A prime to come to charge now. So I'll discuss two hints for the existence of an A prime from data. One of them comes from the measurement of the muon synonymous finite moment. And let me just remind you what that is. So there is a written down an equation here which relates the magnetic dipole moment of an elementary particle to its spin. And it depends, of course, on the charge of the elementary particle Q here, the charge and the mass of this particle M. But there's a proportionality constant which is called G sub S here, with the G factor, and it can be measured very accurately for the electron and the muon. And in the standard model, a long time ago, Dirac calculated what this G sub S should be, and diagrammatically you can represent it with this diagram here with the muon, so for the muon now, where the muon couples to the photon, and he found that G sub S should be equal to 2. So this was one of the first calculations done in field theory. In the standard model, of course, there are many other corrections to this diagram. For example, there's a photon that can be exchanged here, and that changes G sub S from being exactly equal to 2, and there's a small difference between 2 and the real value of G sub S. And the difference from 2 is called an anomalous magnetic moment. So the G minus 2, basically. So there are many other corrections here in the standard model, not just the photon diagram, but once you calculate the standard model conclusion very accurately, people have done that, and they then try to compare it to data, then there's some complication calculating the standard model conclusion, but at least in some calculations, what you get is a 3.4 sigma deviation between the standard model prediction and the data. So this is nothing to, get perhaps too excited about. It is only 3.4 sigma away, but it is still very interesting. To try and explain this with new physics, and people have done it over the years, and it turns out that, as McKean pointed out, that the A prime, since it couples to an electrically charged matter, some particular also muons, you can write down a diagram that I've shown here, and it turns out that for the right mass and epsilon, you can explain this discrepancy of the observed G minus 2. And to show you that on a plot, so what I'm showing you here is a plot of epsilon, so the mixing parameter between the photon and the A prime, on the virtual axis. And on the horizontal axis is the A prime mass. I'm going here from 10 minus 9 for epsilon down to 10 minus 2, so really large range. And from V and V up to 2 dB or so in the A prime mass. This is the parameter region I'll be interested in, and it'll come up later in the talk where I'm going to try and fill in this parameter space with existing constraints, also with how we're trying to fit up the rest of the parameter space. But for now, I've just shown two constraints and this preferred region for the G minus 2. So this green band here, this is where you want to lie at the epsilon A prime mass parameter space to explain the observed G minus 2. So what you notice is that you want to lie at quite large epsilons, 10 minus 3 up to 10 minus 2, and there's also this energy range, a mass range from A prime from a few of the up to a G or so, which could explain this discrepancy between the observed and the standard model predicted G minus 2. What I've shown also here is the G minus 2 constraint from the electron, so that constrains you for large epsilons and for low masses of A prime. And of course, if epsilon is too large, then it would mess up the measurements of the G minus 2 of the muon by too much, and this is sort of the region that's then excluded for very large epsilons. But this is the band you want to lie in this green band here. So that's one hint. Another hint comes from the cognitive frontier. And this, as I mentioned already, has driven a lot of excitement for the existence of an A prime over the last 2 years or so. And the idea is that what if dark matter doesn't couple to ordinary forces? So what if it doesn't couple to W and D bosons or photons or gluons? But instead, what if it couples to this new force area at A prime? And the effect of that is that dark matter now has a new interaction between, there's a new interaction now between dark matter and ordinary matter. So because the dark matter couples with A prime, and the A prime couples to ordinary matter, it allows dark matter to interact with ordinary matter. And there's some very interesting consequences that are possible in this case. One of them is that dark matter could annihilate two A products. So what we want to imagine is that there is perhaps GeV scale dark matter, so 1,000 GeV, 1,000 times mass per proton dark matter, annihilating two A primes. And let's imagine that these A primes are have a mass between M and B and GeV. If that's the case, then these A primes will decay to stand among matter, so a particular charged lepton, or a particular electron and muons, and positrons, and antineurons. And the electrons and positrons will propagate, or what you're going to generate, very high energy electrons and positrons from this decay process, because the mass of the dark matter particles is GeV, and of course these particles, the electron and muon, are very light. And if you generate muons, for example, they'll decay further to give you electron and positron. So what you're generating is very high energy electrons and positrons from this process. What you are not generating is antiprotons. So if this mass of the A prime is less than a GeV, you are automatically forbidden from decaying into protons and antiprotons, since they have a mass of the GeV. So if this is the case, then you can make a prediction that you should see high energy cosmic ray electrons and positrons, and no high energy antiprotons at high energy. And it turns out, of course, that's exactly what is being observed. So there are several satellites that are looking for antimatter. These satellites are they're in space, of course, and they are looking for antimatter. And in particular, look for positrons and also antiprotons. And what they have seen is an excess in positrons at high energy. So here's a plot from the Kamela satellite where I'm showing the series station here in black. This is just from normal astrophysical processes, normal standard model processes. But there is this rise, as shown here by the red data, about 10 GeV going to 100 GeV when the data runs out, that shows this excess in positrons, high energy positrons. An excess in electrons and positrons is also shown by the Fermi collaboration, so there's an electron and positron excess at high energy. In blue here is the theory expectation from astrophysics, and in red is this data which shows you this excess about what was expected. So this shows you that there's an excess of electrons and positrons, which could be from dark matter. And when these experiments look for antimatter, the surprising thing is that, well, they found this positron excess, but they did not find an antiproton excess. So here's the theory expectation of black for the number of antiprotons of a proton, and in red here is the data that was found also by the Kamela satellite, and you see that they agree reasonably well. So there's no excess in antiprotons, and of course an excess in positrons. That is exactly what is predicted in some sense by this model of saying dark matter coming to an A prime. Now, of course, I'm presenting it as a prediction of the model. These models were, of course, motivated also by the data. So the other option, besides dark matter being able to annihilate to A prime, dark matter can also scatter off nuclei in some detector via exchanging at A prime. And the idea that dark matter comes in, and you've got detectors on Earth that have nuclei like germanium or xenon or something in it, and by exchanging A prime, it allows the dark matter to scatter off these nuclei, and then you look for the nuclear recoil. So there are experiments called direct dark matter effect experiments, two of them that I'll just mention, they won't be important to the talk. But I'll just mention that Dharma and Kojin, for example, are two of these experiments that have been seeing a signal which they cannot explain with astrophysics or with any other known standard model background. And it might be suggested with dark matter. And it turns out that an A prime coming to dark matter might be able to explain these signals. So let me summarize the beginning here. So basically what I'm going to be talking about for the rest of the talk is an A prime that couples two quarks and charged electrons. The mass of the A prime is between M and B and GeV, and this epsilon is between this Mitchell parameter, the coupling of A prime to charged matter, is between 10 minus 8 and 10 minus. That's sort of the reason I want to probe it. And as I mentioned, it's very natural, and there's also different hints from T minus 2 and Docker anomalies suggesting something like this. Now, I want to just emphasize that irrespective of these hints, which are speculative, so there are other reasons, there are other ways to explain the G minus 2 anomaly, there are other ways to explain positron access. But irrespective of these hints, the idea that there are new forces between M and B and the GE scale has not been systematically explored so far. So even though this is speculative, if you find this, it would have a huge impact, and it would have an impact that's as large as anything that any finds. So it is worth looking for these things, I think, irrespective of any one might have that they actually exist. So the question on the rest of the talk is, how can we test this? So, getting to my outline, I will now discuss the two different probes, so the cosmic frontier and then the test frontier. So, let's now, for the next few minutes, take seriously the idea that dark matter is annihilating to these A primes and ask, what are the possible consequences? And I will just mention one possible consequence. This is that you are guaranteed to get photons. So, this is the process we are going to be assuming now. Dark matter couples to A primes, annihilates to them, and then they decay to charge electrons. If you have a diagram like this, if you have a process like this, you're also guaranteed to have a process where you're radiating a photon from one of these charged leptons. This is called final state radiation, and these photons are guaranteed. So you're guaranteed there must be photons that you should be able to observe. And you can try to find, or you can try to look for these photons, either with Fermi or with atmospheric transit telescopes. So Fermi is a satellite, right, the gamma ray space telescope, looking for gamma rays, and they can observe, they can look for these photons. And there are also ground-based gamma ray instruments, so-called atmospheric triangle telescopes, such as Veritas, and MAGIC. So here's the consequence, you're guaranteed to get photons. So where should you look for the photons? There are many ways, many places to look for these photons. What I'm showing you here is a simulation from the gamma ray sky from dark matter annihilation. And your red stuff is supposed to show you where most of the dark matter is concentrated and where you would find the largest signal. What you notice is that here in the middle, in the galactic center, is where you expect most photons to come from if dark matter is annihilating and producing photons. That's where the signal is the largest. But what you also notice is that there are these little bright red spots surrounded in the halo that I'm trying to point out here. These little bright red spots, and these come from so-called dwarf galaxies. So dwarf galaxies are sort of mini galaxies, which there are dark matter subhalos within our big Milky Way dark matter halo. Some of these subhalos contain stars, and then you can see them in the optical, where you can detect them as those sort of small mini galaxies. They're close by, and they tend to also be at high galactic latitudes, so far away from the center. And the nice thing is that, well, this makes them particularly attractive because even though the signal, as you can see, is certainly largest here in the galactic center, if you look at the real gamma ray sky, given the picture of the real observed gamma ray sky from the Fermi gamma ray space telescope, so this is just astrophysics, and what you notice is that the galactic plane, but a particular galactic center, is very messy. There's a huge amount of gamma ray background in this galactic center. So if you want to disentangle a dark matter signal here, it will be what is very difficult. However, dwarf galaxies, since they lie at high galactic latitudes, there are a good choice to look for dark matter annihilation, because any signal that you would see at high galactic latitudes, for any gamma ray signal that you would see from a dwarf galaxy would be very suggestive of dark matter annihilation. Another reason why dwarf galaxies are a particularly good choice for the A prime scenario, it turns out that dwarf galaxies are a particularly good choice for the A prime scenario, and that is what I want to explain now. So just to summarize this idea, so dwarf galaxies, that's what I'll be focusing on. As I mentioned, the dark matter dominated, and they're also nearby and have a low astrophysical background. But the reason they're a particularly good choice for the A prime scenario is that the dark matter that's contained in the dwarf galaxy has a very low velocity. So if you compare the velocity of the dark matter in the dwarf galaxy to our Milky Way halo, it is about a factor of 20 or so lower. The dark matter is much colder and has much more velocity. And the reason is because these are smaller bound systems, and there's not as much mass in them to gravitationally bound the system, so the velocity of the dark matter has to be a little bit smaller than the big Milky Way halo, otherwise you can't show that gravitationally bound system. So why is having a small velocity good for the A prime scenario? The reason is because the light A prime mediates a long range force. Let me try and explain what the effect of that is. So I'm going to give you first a classical analogy. So you can think of the A prime meeting long range force that's sort of similar to gravity. I'll tell you in a minute how it's different. But imagine that we have two planets that are going towards each other, except that imagine that if there's no gravity, they would just go past each other. So they're going on straight lines here. And they would miss each other if there's no gravity acting. And if they're going, so let's turn on gravity now, but let's assume that these planets are going really, really fast at very large velocities, then gravity does not have enough time to interact, to pull these things together, and they will just miss each other. But if the velocity of these planets is very small, then gravity has lots of time to act, and it will pull these planets in so that the cross-section, that annihilation cross-section, the probability for them colliding is proportional to 1 over the velocity. So what you see is that a very low velocity probability of these two planets colliding is very large. So basically the cross-section for these planets to collide is 4-1 over velocity. So an A prime is not gravity, but it's similar in the sense that it also mediates a long-range force. And the quantum mechanical analog of the classical thing I just described is shown in this diagram. So if you have dark matter particles coming along, they're going very slowly. The slower they go, the more time they have to interact with A prime before they eventually annihilate to them. And this annihilation process for this process is called Sommerfeld enhancement, and it gives you an enhancement at low velocity. The way the gravitational force is different from an A prime is that the A prime is massive, so that the force it mediates is not infinite range like the gravitational force, but it has a finite range. So it's not a long range force, but it's a finite range. In particular, if the A prime mass is very large, the shorter the range of force, and eventually this will saturate, so we will not get any additional enhancement at some point when the velocity of the dark matter becomes small. Particularly, the velocity of the dark matter becomes less than A prime mass or the dark matter mass, you will not get any additional enhancement beyond the one that you already have at larger velocities. So if you want to get a large annihilation cross section, what you need is very small A prime masses and, of course, a small dark matter velocity. Then this annihilation cross section can be very large. So getting back to the dwarf galaxies now, they have a very small velocity. So they've got a factor of 20 lower velocity than the dark matter in the Milky Way halo. And this, of course, then means that they can have a very large Sommerfeld enhancement if the A prime mass is small. So this allows dwarf galaxies to probe very small A prime masses. Okay. So let me give you an example, a numerical example of how this works, just a quantitative example. So here, let's consider the process now with dark matter annihilated to A prime, state decay to electrons and positrons. And what I'm showing here is the cross section, the annihilation cross section for this process as a function of the dark matter mass. So I'm considering a large range of dark matter masses. And what I'm showing here are the preferred regions to explain the Kamala and Fermi cosmic ray positron electron excesses. So green is the region that you want to live in the cross-section map plane to explain the Kamala positron excess, and in red is the region you want to live in to explain the Fermi electron and positron excess. And here, if you want to explain both of them, you want to live in the region here, where you want to, the dark matter have a mass around it, eV, 1000 eV, And across that bars, that's kind of my force. So now let's take this diagram here, and let's calculate what the annihilation cross-section is. We're going to assume that the dark matter makes up all the dark matter in the universe that has the right thermic relative abundance, and then that allows us to fix our coupling. And then let's say, let's ask, what is the cross-section?
If a prime and the photon mix, then it should be possible for the photon to couple directly to dark matter. So then dark matter would shine.
No, it would not have a charge. The real photon doesn't couple, but it will have a charge radius on this kind of model.
Well, why it doesn't couple? I mean, it couples
yeah, to because the
a prime and the photon.
Well, this is a very, very good question, easy to answer.
Okay.
If you have a line like that, and you have this photon dark matter, and then there is this vector. Right, and the photon, the vertex here has an extra q squared because it's f mu nu times f mu nu dual, right? So this is like a both a prime, right? So there is an extra q squared at the vertex. So therefore, in the limit of small q squared, it's not a charge, but a charge. If the mass of the vector is zero, then it's a model for merely charged part.
So it's the Hedgehog that comes in.
Everyone credits, including myself, credits Bob Holden. That's very good. But there was also an earlier paper by Hawkwood with a 2x2 matrix mass for the photons with terminal zero, which is actually equivalent to a Holden model.
But why it doesn't couple in any other way other than, you know, makes sense?
It's a leading order operator, right? Only dimension 4 operator, which you can have. Otherwise, you can also gauge some additional, say, along the free symmetries of the standard model. You can gauge B minus L and do this.
The cross section, so we have the cross section for the semicolon constant as a function of the dark matter mass, and by assuming that the dark matter velocity is that of our halo, we get this purple line here. And what you notice is that for this region right here, we intersect exactly the region preferred by Amada and Fermi. So that's great because it tells us that this scenario with dark matter radiation state lines in the case of positrons works to explain the Amada and Fermi excesses. Now, we can now ask, well, what is the cross-section in the dwarf galaxy? And the cross-section of the dwarf galaxy will, of course, be larger because the velocity of the dark matter of the dwarf galaxy is smaller, and what you find is this blue region here. Now, these resonance regions come about if you do a very careful calculation of this diagram, so you find some resonance regions which relate to zero fast sound states, but that's not important for this talk here. But what you notice is that it's larger at this cross-section. So now when we have the dwarf galaxy, we can now ask the question, well, what if we have this annihilation take place in the dwarf galaxies where we're producing electrons and positrons, then we will also have a process where we're producing photons from final state radiation, the diagram I showed you earlier. And this then means that we can look for these photons, and that is what some ground-based instruments have done, and also the Fermi satellite has done. And I'm going to show you a constraint that you get from one of the ground-based instruments, the so-called MAGIC gamma ray telescope, so that's shown here on the top left. And this black line, they didn't see any gamma ray signal from the dwarf galaxy, and the constraint that you then set on the cross-section mass line is shown by this black region here. So in this region here, what you notice that, so this is this favored, and what you notice is that the dwarf galaxy, by looking at the constraint in the dwarf galaxy, rules out this blue region here. And this contains most of what the cross-section will be in the dwarf galaxy. So what this tells us is that this region is disfavored. Now what I've done for this calculation, what I should have said at the beginning, is that I've chosen a very low rate fine mass of 100 MeV. So for 100 MeV, this is what you get. And this is disfavored. Now of course,
if we make the A prime mass larger, then the Sutherland enhancement is not that large. In fact, it saturates at lower velocities. And then what you get, just for comparison, is shown on this graph here. So this is for a 1,000 MeV A prime mass, 1 GeV A prime mass. And what you find now is that these blue regions, the cross section of the dwarf, are below the constraint from shown by this black line here. So low A prime masses are disfavored from developing dwarf galaxies, and large A prime masses, okay. So A primes can be indirectly controlled by looking at dwarf galaxies. So let me now go to the intensity frontier. I'm just quickly going to see whether I can get this polycom to work one more time, and also make sure that no one's writing a message. Okay, so at the intensity frontier, I'm going to talk about two different things. One, I'll be very brief on, that's the E plus E minus colliders. So this now doesn't depend on the idea that dark matter couple straight primes, this is sort of independent. You can directly probe these GV scale particles with E plus E minus colliders. And the way you do that, one of the ways you do that, is that you take electron and positrons, you collide them, and you can produce a photon here, and then an A prime. And this A prime can then decay further to ordinary matter. But the cross section for this process, I'm showing you on the top right, is proportional to epsilon squared, so that's the genetic mixing parameter. So that's the vertex that appears here. And it's proportional to 1 over the center mass energy squared. So for very large, so for very low energies, you get a very large cross section. So what you want in order to probe this GeV scale directly with the plus minus colliders is a very low energy collider, so 1 to 10 GeV. But the collider, of course, has a lot of data. And those exist. So there are Babar, Bell, Chloe, and others. They have a huge amount of data and they have very low energies, which are ideal probes for this physics. As I mentioned, the A prime can now decay to electrons, for example, or muons, or E plus E minus, U plus E minus, and other standard particles. Or we can imagine that this hidden sector is much more complicated, and the A prime decays to other hidden sector particles, light particles that are coupled to. And then you can get very complicated signals, a very diverse set of signals. And so, in principle, a broad array of searches are needed. And several people have pointed out, myself and collaborators included, and also Brian and Kasim and collaborators, there are a broad array of searches that are needed. And many of these are on the way. So, being at Slack, talking to Babar people, it was easy to get some of these searches going, and they're being done right now. So, let me just show you one constraint that you get from a process that people have looked for. So this is if you take electrons and positrons here, and you collide them to a photon and A primes, and the A prime decays two muons. So they look for two muons and a photon. And what you get is this constraint that I'm showing at the top right here. So this is the picture I showed earlier in the talk, where I'm showing epsilon and function of A prime mass. And I'm showing these constraints from G minus to the electron and muon. This green band where you want to live in to explain the G minus to the muon. And this constraint from the data that was looked at by Babar, that only looked at part of the data, is shown here. So you notice that it's for very large epsilons, and of course, for masses of A primes, about twice the muon mass. So this is only, was only done in the partial data set of Babar, they didn't look at the whole data set. Bell could do the same kind of analysis. Bell is the other collider that's very similar to Babar, it's a 10 GeV collider also, but they actually have a bit more data. And if Bell were to do this analysis and set a constraint, then they will be able to probe this region that I'm showing you by this dashed line. So it goes down to a little bit more on epsilon, but still epsilon's above 10 of lambda 3. So this just shows you a very one example of how E plus E minus colliders can probe for these GeV scale sectors directly. And since I'm now at the outline again, I'm just going to quickly check if I can get the polycom to work one more time. Okay, it doesn't seem to work. Let's check with my messages. Okay, very good. So let's now turn to the final topic for this talk, and this is probing the GeV scale and fixed target experiments. In particular, I'll mention two of them, APEX and HPS, where I'm involved in that are looking for these A-frames. So let me begin by telling you what a fixed type burn is and how it produces A-primes. And the way this works is sort of very simple. What you do is you take a magnetron beam and you shoot it onto a target, a fixed target. So that's why these are called fixed target experiments. And while the electron is interacting with the nuclei in your target, you can produce A primes in a way that's analogous to photon Bernstein. So you take the electron, it comes in, you exchange a photon with the nucleus, you radiate an A prime from the electron beam. It's like photon Bernstein, except now you radiate a heavy particle, a massive particle, so it actually produces mostly forward and carries most beam energy. The cross section for this process is of course proportional to epsilon squared, because that's the coupling that appears when A prime comes to electrons. But it's also proportional to Z squared, where Z is the atomic number of the nucleus. So what you want is a very heavy nucleus, such as tungsten or tantalum, as opposed to a light nucleus, to produce many A primes. So the A prime now travels after it's produced, and it will eventually decay to electrons and positrons. It of course depends on what the coupling is between the A prime and the standard model of how quickly, so what the light term is of how quickly it decays to electrons and positrons. And then what you can do now is you can put a shield behind your target. The shield could be anything between your centimeter up to kilometers as well. And the prime does not interact with part of the shield. It's very penetrating, and it'll just go through it. And eventually it'll decay to plus and minus, and then you want to put a detector there to look for the plus and minus pairs. So that's your basic setup for a fixed target experiment. The thing that helps you further is that the thing that helps to distinguish the signal from background processes is that the electron and positron pairs that you get from an A prime, if you calculate their bearing mass, that should equal to the A prime mass, because the A prime is produced on a shell. So what you should see is a resonance about background, if there's any background, and that helps to distinguish the signal from the background. The other thing to note is that the larger the shield, the less is the background. So the larger you make the shield, the less chance there is for electrons interacting with the target, so normal standard model processes, to produce background events that also give you electrons and positrons. So what region do we want to probe? So what region do we want to probe? We want to probe basically this whole Brenner region that I've been showing earlier, and we want to probe this whole parameter region. And what you notice is that the life term of the A prime in this parameter space varies by orders of magnitude. So if we ask what the life term is up here, I'm showing you a life term line for when A prime decays off 1 micrometer. So that's a very large epsilon. As you go lower in epsilon, down to this line here, the second one for the top, you find that the life term of the A prime is 1 centimeter. And then as you keep going lower, you find that the life term costs 10 meters, and of course, more and more as you keep going to lower and lower epsilons. So, while even the constraints I've discussed so far up here, you notice that if we want to probe the rest of this parameter space, we need various strategies. No single experiment is going to cover this whole thing, because the life time varies by so many orders of magnitude in this range. So, fortunately, there have been experiments done which have had a very large shield. These experiments are so-called beam dumps, where you take an electron beam, for example, and you dump the whole beam, so you shoot all the electrons onto target, and the shield is so thick that nothing gets out behind, gets through the shield, and then behind the shield you eventually put a detector. And it turns out that very good beam dump constraints really exist from experiments that were done in the 1980s. These experiments looked for axions, actually, decaying to plus or minus. We took those constraints and reinterpreted the bounds for an A prime, and the three experiments that I'm showing here are E774, E141, and E137. So those are constraints for beam dumps. And you notice that they're not probing this region up here. That's where the lifetime is short, and that's the region where the A prime would have decayed inside the shield, and then the A prime would not have penetrated
through the shield. Sorry, the decay products would not have penetrated through the shield, which would not have seen the decay products, the plus or minus decay from the eight, right? There's also a constraint I'm showing here for supernova, which I'll discuss. And I just want to mention that proton beams can also set very interesting constraints, as was first pointed out by Brian and Maxime and collaborators. And then we also looked at that. So myself and others looked at this too. But I don't want to discuss that in any detail today. So what we need is basically new experiments to explore this interesting region up here. This region, you notice, contains the G-2 line, the third region where an acron can extend the G-2 region, green band here. And also, it lies in the mass range, which could explain these cosmic ray anomalies with dark matter coming to an A-prime. Now, the thing that, what I already mentioned, that the thing that distinguishes this region up here from the region lower down is that the A-prime lifetime is very short. So what you need is a very thin target and no shield at all, so that the A-prime does not decay inside the shield or inside your target, preferably. And of course, if you have a very thin shield and no shield at all and a very thin target, you're going to get a huge background just from ordinary stamina processes. And this, the way you then distinguish the signals from the background is to look for resonances or to look for a space vertex. So just to explain that a little bit, what we do is that we have a huge, what we have is a very huge background from quantum electrodynamic processes that produce E plus and minus pairs. That's going to give us some spectrum like this, shaped by, you know, the acceptance of the spectrometers and so on that we use to detect E plus and minus pairs. This is a function of the E plus and minus Hilbert mass. But if an A-prime exists, it's going to stick out like little resonance, or orbital resonance at some particular mass, then you have the A-prime mass, and we can look for this resonance by doing a little bump punch. The alternative thing is that for regions where epsilon is a little bit smaller, so down here, this lifetime of the A-prime is about a centimeter or so that the A-prime is produced after the electron hits the target, and then it would move a little centimeter, maybe 10 centimeters, and then decay G plus and minus pairs. So by tracking these electron positron pairs back to where they come from, we could find that they originate from a vertex that does not coincide with the target. So these are two strategies to reduce, or this is a strategy to reduce the background, because the background is of course not going to have the same vertex, and also by looking for this resonance that tells us that we're not seeing background processes. Okay, let me make sure that no one is telling me I'm not aligning more. Okay. Very good. So what we've done about 1.5 years ago is we suggested several experimental scenarios to look for these A-primes in this high epsilon region, and we've developed several proposals since June 2009 that have turned to real experimental proposals and real experiments. And instead of just going through this diagram here, which is very messy, I just want to sort of pick out 2 points and tell you about 2 experiments. One of them is the so-called A-prime experiments, or APEX. So you see a lot of folk with that name, so A-prime experiments, or APEX. This is supposed to take place at Jetson Lab in Collider Hall A. So Jetson Lab, as I mentioned, is a facility, additional media facility, about 3 hours southeast of Washington, D.C., it's one of the national labs in the U.S. And here's an aerial picture of them. There are 3 collider halls, A, B, C, shown here. There's also another one called collider hall D. And in collider hall A, they have 2 high-resolution spectrometers where you can detect the electron of one of them and the positron of the other spectrometer. And this allows you to look at the electron, positron, measure momentum very precisely. So I'm the spokesperson of this experiment together with Philip Trusa and Sandro Toro and experimenters at Jetson Lab, Martin Laskowski. We have a collaboration of more than 100 people from about 30 institutions. And the nice thing about this experiment is that it uses mostly existing equipment. We're using the existing equipment in collider hall A, which makes it a very cheap experiment to run. Here's a picture of the spectrometers in collider hall A. So just here's the full size, and what you notice is they're very big. This is the size of a person, this red line here, just for scale. And here's a picture of the thin target system in that we're using for APEX. So
So notice there is 10 folders here that are holding these 10 tungsten targets by 10 microns thick. And that's our 10 targets. When we say that, we do mean 3 targets by 10 microns thick. So we actually had a test run in June 2010. We collected about 10% data. We collected data, and I'm showing you about 10% of it. This is the number of events, the function that they're in mass. And I'm showing what you see here is, of course, QED background, just from processes from quantum electrodynamics, which are these two diagrams down here. And if an A prime exists, it would stick out, for example, like this. So we've got very good mass resolution. And basically, what we're going to do is we're going to collect many, many plus minus pairs and then look for a little bump out and hopefully find something that sticks out like this. So the projected read for this experiment is shown here. So I zoomed in a little bit of this epsilon A prime mass parameter space. This green band again is the G minus 2 preferred region. The test run that we had gives the projected sensitivity. And you notice that this is not a limit, it's just a projected sensitivity. We're doing a bind analysis, so we're only open 10% of the data that we're going to show you. But once the analysis is complete, we think we can be sensitive to this region. This is the proposed full run. It takes place over about 30 to 40 days to full run. And it has these wiggles here because we're putting together four different energy settings, four different shorter runs, basically. And that's why there's a little dip here, so this is not a physical thing. It's just depends on how we chose our settings. And the exciting thing is that this experiment has been fully approved last month by the Program Advisory Committee at Jefferson Lab. And we hope to take data over the next 2 years and then look for an A prime like that. So just for comparison, I'm showing here the potential reach that this Bell collider could have. So Bell is one of the lower energy plus minus colliders, and it takes it collected data for over a decade. And you see that this is the reach they could have, and you see that a dedicated experiment like APIS can achieve much, much more in a tiny fraction of the time. So about 30, 40 days, you can do much more than Bell is able to do for this kind of physics in a decade. So very briefly, the second experiment, the heavy particle search. This experiment has been proposed at Jefferson Lab in 4B. So it's a collider of A like A basis, a collider of 4B now. There are about 60 collaborators on this experiment from 60 institutions. And the heavy particle search, what distinguishes it is that it's a vertex experiment. So behind the target, we have these silicon tracking elements that track the plus and minus pairs very accurately. And by tracking them from where they come from, we can look for tiny vertices behind the target, so about a centimeter to 10 centimeters big. And there's also a calorimeter and also a muon chamber, so we can look for muons also, for A-primes to change muons. The experimental cost for this experiment is slightly more than APEX. It's much more than APEX. It's about $3 million. Here's the projected reach. So it has two regions. It's up here. There's a region we're looking for a resonance in red here, and the vertex region is down here. We'll be looking for a vertex of about a centimeter to 10 centimeters or so. And what you notice is that it has a larger reach than APEX. It runs also for a longer time, about 1 year. The exciting thing is that the test run has been approved also last month. So the test run will take place in 1 year from now, and then the full experiment will be run over the next 5 years or so. And I want to discuss this as well. So, just to summarize, here are the experiments, APEX and heavy particle search, that I am involved in and that have this reach that I'm showing here. There are other experiments that have been proposed also to look for this physics. Just very briefly, there's an experiment at MITES that recently actually published a limit where they looked for a prime. It's an experiment that's basically modeled off of the APEX experiment. So they saw the phone there, they said they could also do this experiment. And they recently released a paper with a limit that's covering this orange bag here. Also just the test that I had. And the full run will, of course, be kind of larger reach. And there's also an experiment at MIT called Dark Light, which uses a lower energy beam at Jefferson Lab, which covers the low mass region, big part of the G minus 2 region here. And this is also a beamed up experiment that is being done or being proposed at DESI in Germany called HIPS. And this experiment is modeled after one of the beamed ups we suggested in the paper. and make the probe logger epsilon here. So these experiments will initiate just of a snatch duration for weekly couple of GDCL forces, and you notice they'll cover the G minus 2 region and also a big part of the region that's motivated by dark matter. But of course, there's still gaps in here, so future experiments will have to try and close those. So to summarize, let me conclude. The idea of new GDCL forces, I think, is a very exciting and well motivated idea. It can be indirectly probed with dwarf galaxies at the quantum frontier. I discussed that low A prime masses can be constrained already from dwarf galaxies. And then I discussed direct searches, so directly probing the GD scale sectors with E plus or minus colliders and new fixed target experiments. What I didn't discuss was science search that can be done at on LHC at the high energy frontier, but those definitely exist. So there's a new experimental that's underway. And it's a very exciting time now to be in quantum physics because we're really entering an era of data where many quantum discoveries are possible at all three of the quantum physics frontiers, the quantum intensity and energy frontier. So thank you very much.
I'm going to make some contrarian statements. You said in the abstract of your paper that dark matter exists beyond time. No one's actually detected dark matter yet, these particles. We only infer it from gravity. Another issue is what about the Hess data regarding positron excess? If you look at it, it's not clearly inconsistent with the lack of the positron excess. Another question is, the G minus 2, it's somewhat muddied by QCD corrections. And there's a lot of controversy about this. In fact, there are calculations showing that the discrepancy could be 2 sigma or less. Another issue is depletion of dwarf galaxies. Papers have appeared on the archive from astronomers who have done calculations showing that these dwarf galaxies are not in dynamical equilibrium, which could explain the large mass to light migration without dark matter. So these are some of the issues.
Have you written it all down?
Yeah, okay. So thank you for the question. Okay, so dark matter, there are certainly alternative theories for dark matter. I think the evidence for dark matter is very, very strong. People can argue about that, and we can talk about that afterwards, but there's a lot of evidence for dark matter that does exist. But I do understand that there are alternatives out there. The question about Hess, Hess did look at electrons and positrons. They are able to only do high energies also, and I don't have a plot here, but it is consistent with the Fermi data, the plus or minus data. Can you see my slide here?
Yeah.
Okay, so it is actually consistent with the E plus and minus data. The Hess data has larger systematic uncertainty because it's much more difficult to separate the background from the electrons and positrons, but it is consistent with that data. And also, in fact, it goes down above. So I guess I'm just looking at the slide here. Yeah, it's not the best part, but there's a Hess 2008, which I think are these triangles here. And there's a lot, what's not shown here is that there's a systematic uncertainty, so this could actually, there seems to be a break about a TED or so. G minus 2, what I did say during the talk was that there are, to calculate the standard model contribution,
is G minus 2, so I could, as I mentioned in the talk, there are, it's complicated to calculate the standard model contribution. I think there's a joint contribution here. And with the photon, there's a loop of hadrons that can be included. And that contribution is the estimate of data. And depending on what estimate you take, you get slightly different answers. The one that's usually quoted is the one I'm quoting, that the 3.4, which is a 3.4 sigma deviation. The other way of doing the calculation is using different data to estimate the running contribution gives you about deviation that's less than 2 sigma. So the metric has nothing to get overly excited about, but certainly the A prime can help you explain that. And the last question was about dwarf galaxies and whether they're dynamically relaxed.
So there are people who are much more expert than I am on this topic who look at these things and study these objects, and there's a lot of evidence that they are dynamically relaxed, at least within a small enough radius close enough to the center of the galaxy. And the limits that we calculate are pretty conservative, taking into account that the dwarfs do not extend too far beyond this tidal radius. So, as I mentioned, so that people that are more expert than I am who claim that they are dynamically relaxed and that you can do a reliable calculation.